You know, Bob, we cover every other country's traditions, but what about our own? One episode, we should just discuss our own family's fun Christmas activities.
That's a great idea. Like making cherry tarts.
Cherry tarts for the holiday? Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, to celebrate when Jesus cut down Joseph's cherry tree and couldn't tell a lie.
Wait, what?
And we also serve corn casserole, or we like to call it maize casserole, in honor of, you know, when Jesus had dinner with the Native Americans.
What?
Oh, and we also hide ornaments outside to find and put on the tree. Plus, if you see your shadow when you're out looking for them, guess what? There's another 6 weeks of Christmas.
You know, maybe let's just stick to the foreign customs for now.
Oh, but Mark, I'm so excited to celebrate Jesus' big day with the Native Americans this year. We all know that if he didn't show them how to turn water into wine, that we wouldn't have anything to celebrate.
The more you know.
The following podcast contains graphic descriptions of international celebrating and global merrymaking. It may not be suitable for angry or unhappy audience members. Listener discretion is advised. You've been warned.
Have you ever seen any of those foreign films? I don't like them.
Some are born great, others achieve greatness, and some watch Christmas movies.
For Natale! God is camping!
We are the wild and pretty guys!
But they're both festive, aren't they?
And we are the Festive Foreign Film Fans. Hey, Mark.
Yeah?
What is the favorite Christmas song in Alaska?
In Alaska? I don't know.
There's no place like Nome for the holidays.
Wow.
Oh, Mark, it's another special treat for the festive fans.
It really is.
We always try to do something fun around Thanksgiving, and tonight is really fun because we're not heading out into the world. We are instead, we're heading back.
Yes.
Back into time. I know this is hard to believe for you guys. Seriously, there was a time when Mark and I were even more handsome and virile.
One of those two is true.
And other than having that in common, we also shared another unique employment circumstance.
I know. This is crazy.
We both worked in Alaska. I was on a fishing boat and Mark was on a drilling rig. Can you just feel the testosterone level just rising in this room?
I'm a lumberjack and that's okay.
That explains your outfit.
Thank you.
So it was the 1980s. And we were discovering our rugged selves before we settled down into our current lives of domestic tranquility. The biggest question in this expose, in the lives of your hosts, is what drew us to the Great White North? Mm-hmm. What was it? How did we, I was here in Illinois and you were Pennsylvania at the time?
I was.
You know, how did we end up there? And what are our lasting impressions? I'll tell you my story. I can say that my adventure began when I was in college. I was at the University of Iowa, and I was a sophomore, and I had two roommates who read an ad on the back page of the college newspaper. You know, they always had those ads, classifieds.
Yeah.
And they had this one about jobs in Alaska, make big money, and fishing in Alaska. And they decided, hey, let's go. This will be great. They asked me, and I'm like, the last thing I ever wanted to do is go spend the summer on a fishing boat. The months went by, and they got all excited about this, and I had no job. I still had no job. They wore me down. I finally agreed, and we bought plane tickets.
Okay.
We got on a plane, and Mark, that was the extent of our planning.
Wow.
We packed stuff, clothes. Wow. We got off the plane in the airport. Now I look back on it. I swear we thought there'd be people in the airport signing you up. Oh, you're looking for a job? Here you go. We couldn't be more wrong. We landed. We're like, okay, now what do we do?
What do you do?
I mean, we had little money, no jobs, but we had to survive until we could find jobs. So the first thing that struck me, I hadn't at that point hadn't really traveled very much at all. So the scenery in Anchorage was spectacular. It was outstanding. Yeah. I just loved to look out on the mountains. But the other thing, and you know, again, college student, it's surprising that this stood out to me, but I was amazed at their zoning laws because you would have businesses, houses, rundown places all in a row. And I was like, I'd never seen that before. So what we had to do, because we had no money and we didn't know what to do, we found a motel and we moved into this motel. And I'm not kidding. We made friends with the people also living there.
Oh,
there were heroin addicts. We had prostitutes. Incredibly nice people, though, I have to tell you. We also had to eat. So we're like, what do we do? So we first worked at a Burger King, but they fired us because we were not fast enough. So that didn't work. So then we went to Pizza Hut. And what was great about that is, and I think it explains some of the employment opportunities in Alaska. We showed up and after our first week, we're closing the place.
Oh my goodness.
Which is awesome because we made ourselves pizzas. We had beer so we could feed ourselves. What we did is we learned talking to people, their manpower, you know, the employment place.
Oh, yeah.
You go to manpower, there would be a huge line of people, college students that all went up there for the same thing. They were filling jobs because at least on the fishing boats, the salmon fishing season was perfect for college students. It runs from May to August. So there we were in line. The three of us ended up on a fishing boat going out of Togiak, Alaska. Togiak is a native village. What is the irony of the whole thing? We go out there and we work about 2 weeks and the two friends of mine that were way into this and really wanted to do it, they're like, this is terrible. We hate this. We're out of here. So they left. I can't even believe they left and I stayed. And not only did I stay for that season, I went back for two more seasons, two more years.
That's incredible.
Really, the reason why I did that, I have to tell you, is because I would go back to college. Things would come up. Oh, what'd you do this summer? And I'd say, I worked on a fishing boat in Alaska. And everyone was always taken with the stories. And I enjoyed telling the story so much that I start to forget about all the things that I hated. I always just remembered the fun kind of things, you know, going to Walrus Island, seeing the Northern Lights, the grizzly bears.
Yeah.
And so I'd fool myself for every year and I'd get off the plane when I landed. It'd come rushing back. I'd be like, oh my gosh.
How did I do this?
All the things I hate. I hated being cold. I hated being wet and I hated being tired. And that was the whole summer because it was long hours, hard manual labor. But when we say lasting impressions, what I will say about it, one, just doing it because I just picked up and did it. And I think that's kind of important. And especially when you think of, I lived in the suburbs of Chicago. I had a very easy life.
Yep.
And I wasn't an outdoorsman at all. I never had fished, never had hunted, never had done any of that stuff. And suddenly here I am handling probably more fish than most of your fishermen will ever handle in their life. Because the fishing wasn't, it was done with nets.
Right.
So you'd pour them down into this big hole in the boat. And sometimes you'd have to get down in and where they're lowering the fish and it was like the fish would rise. It was scary.
That's scary. Yeah. I'm impressed that you went for 3 years.
Oh, yes. All right, Mark, now I want to hear you.
So my story is, I was living in Pennsylvania. I was wrapping up a semester of college as well. And my cousin, Susie, her husband or boyfriend, my cousin lived right next door to me and they were visiting and he said, hey, I'm leaving for Alaska in a couple weeks. Just found out we're shorthanded. Do you want to come with me? You know, I said, Tom, I kind of know what you do. I know it's on a drill rig. He's like, yeah, you'd be like a laborer. You'd be slinging a lot of wrenches and we would leave in May and we should be back by the next semester or you might have to miss next semester. And I was like, I don't think so. And then he told me what I would be making. And I'm like, holy Hannah. And so I literally found out 8 days before I left.
Oh my gosh.
So once I said yes, I had to drive to Scranton and apply for the job. And what's really funny, Bob, I had never been on a plane in my life.
Oh.
So here I was. I had just turned 20 because it was 1980. And so I had to fly from Wilkes-Barre to Pittsburgh to Chicago to Seattle to Anchorage to Juneau to a town called Kotzebue.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is over.
And you had never been on a plane.
Never been on a plane. Never been to the airport.
Wow. And were you by yourself or was
all by my? So here's the thing. Because I was late joining, everybody else went as a crew together. They couldn't get me on the same flight, so I had to fly a day later than everyone else. So I was in the Northern Brook Range. Google the town Kotzebue. And from Kotzebue, go roughly about 130 miles northeast of Kotzebue, and that's where I was. So when we got to Kotzebue, to get to the actual camp we were in, we all went on these small single-engine planes. Being the rookie, the new guy, I got to fly with a bush pilot where all our equipment was in the back. And we're flying, and at one point, he goes, hey, just grab the controls. Just keep it steady. I want to pour myself a coffee. And I'm like, okay. We're kind of getting closer. He's like, oh, over there on the horizon, that's the camp. I said, that's interesting. I said, well, where do we land? Because I had not thought about to ask that question. He was like, I'll find a place. And so literally, he buzzes the camp a few times with the plane. And then he's flying, and there's like an old creek bed that's dried out. And that's where we landed. And what I didn't know why he buzzed the camp was because the helicopters were coming to pick us up.
Oh.
So I'd never been on a small plane, never been on a plane, never been in a helicopter. And so for the next 5 months, I went to work every day in a helicopter.
Really?
Yeah. So the,
wow.
I mean, here's what I was doing. Every year, the Alaskan government would allow mining companies to come and explore the wilderness of Alaska. And the deal was you paid them a fee, but then you also had to share any of their geological findings you had to share with the Alaskan government. Mm-hmm. So the company that I worked for, Sprague & Henwood, was a drilling company out of Pennsylvania who was hired by a mining company out of Washington called Cameco America. And we were exploring just all over the northern part of Alaska. So we would drill anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 feet straight down. And pulling out all these little core samples. And same thing, Bob. I worked 13 days in a row, 12 hours a day. I had one day off, no telephones, no TV.
Nothing.
Nothing. I mean, I used to write Sioux letters. I had no expenses the whole time.
They fed you.
On our one day off, we would wash our greasy clothes and drink whiskey.
And would you get a check at the end? That's how they did it for us.
So they actually deposited checks the whole time I was gone. So my dad was taking the checks.
Oh.
And he would just deposit them into my savings account. Mm-hmm. It was just a hard labor's job. When we actually stopped in Juneau for like a half a day, we stopped there because the Wild Game Commission said like, hey, you're going to be in the wilderness and here's what you have to watch out for. And here's sort of the rules of engagement. You should be armed at all times. So we carried sidearms the whole time.
Wow.
And at our drill station, we had rifles with scopes. You know, I was an outdoorsman. I hunted. I fished.
But was that for bears?
For bears, for wolf, for caribou, for potentially just random people. Because when we were flying out in these small planes, there'd just be cabins along the water.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of the people who were really, truly off the grid. It was a hard labor's job. So we would drill, then we have to change the bit. And quite honestly, back then, I was a stud, man. I mean, and I lost 40 pounds in that time because I was just working and eating and not even eating a lot. So I enjoyed it immensely. To your point, 40 years later, you still say you worked in Alaska. Yeah. And people are like, what? What'd you do? And you tell them all about it.
And you still have that six pack.
Oh, yeah. I'm drinking it. You know, I don't know. Do you have pictures of yourself on the fishing boat?
I do.
I think we should post some pictures. I have pictures of me because I didn't get a haircut. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I met lifelong friends there. But from a wilderness perspective, got to see incredible things. Got to see Northern Lights. Got to see a lot of wildlife. On our 13th day, we'd have a day off. And so the one day was on our 13th day, or coming back, the helicopter pilot said, hey, while you guys were at work, you're not going to believe what happened. And so the migration of the northern caribou herd was coming right by our camp.
Oh, wow.
Tens of thousands of caribou were right across the river passing through us. I mean, the sight, the noise, the rumbling of the ground, right? And the next day, when we got up and the pilot's like, we flew backwards up where they came from. We had so many grizzlies. that were close to our camp because they were feeding on the caribou.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, my God, I had no idea how close they were. So seeing the migration of the caribou, seeing all the grizzly, a pack of wolves came to our drill site one time, and they were so quiet, we never heard or saw them.
Oh.
And then the fishing, like we got to fish, even after we worked sometimes, mm-hmm. we'd go down to the Noatak River and fish for salmon there. And so it was the most incredibly beautiful thing to see. And I grew up in the mountains, but oh my God, these were mountains. But yeah, it was an incredible time. I didn't have the opportunity to go back. I probably would have if the opportunity presented myself, but I was sort of immersed back in school the next year, having to take off a semester to do this.
It just paid for my college. So it was like, yeah. So Mark.
Yes.
Before we speak any further about our life in the great outdoors, we need to get silent and return to our last episode in the trivia in Colombia. Now, I know it's not about the sticker, really.
Yeah.
It's the fix.
Yeah.
The crisp rip of the backing paper, the anticipation of the application, the perfect release when it's pressed to a clean surface. You didn't just want our sticker. You needed it. You could answer this question, and it's a badge that you have scored the goods. We asked about a mayor in Colombia who fired the corrupt traffic cops and he replaced them. And who did he hire? You're not going to believe it. He hired mimes.
Oh my God.
He trained 420 mimes to poke fun at reckless drivers. In traffic, fatalities decreased by 50% as a result because drivers hated being ridiculed and made fun of more than they enjoyed violating the traffic laws.
That's crazy.
If you knew that answer and could present it in a deeply expressive fashion without any words, maybe presenting it on an invisible card or as an interpretive dance or even with the answer trapped inside an imaginary box, our sticker is yours.
Wow.
But that's let's crazy. Return now to Alaska, a state they call the last frontier. It is still a remote, untamed edge of civilization, as we know. There are still areas that appear untouched, wild, sparsely settled, and full of mystery and possibility. So let's go there now, where Christmas is quiet, yet breathtaking, which you wouldn't know from tonight's movie. It's a place of deep connection to nature and to us, the festive fans.
Want to watch a Christmas movie?
Christmas movies are our bread and butter.
We eat Chinese food and watch Christmas movies.
I heard it's the best Christmas movie since Home Alone.
Tonight, we're going to review a movie from 2020 called Fat Man. And when Bob first originally signed me to do this, I took it a little personally, but I think it was just a coincidence. But the movie has three main actors and all household names. Mel Gibson plays Chris or Santa. They never call him Santa.
They never do.
Just Chris. Mel started his career with a few stints on stage and TV shows, really before hitting it big with Mad Max and the movie Tim in 1979. Mad Max made him known worldwide, while Tim garnered him an award for Best Actor from the Australian Film Festival. That's kind of their equivalent to an Oscar.
When I was in college, I had a Mad Max outfit. I wore Mad Max boots. I had a Mad Max leather jacket.
If anyone will write in and say they're surprised by that, I will give you a lifelong supply of our stickers. He went on to star in a number of films, including Lethal Weapon series, which also had a Christmas theme, where he played Martin Riggs. He kind of got controversial near the end of his career here with some of his anti-Semitic and homophobic statements, which have been put on a blacklist. The other person who I think made the movie is Walter Goggins. So before Walter hit it big recently in White Lotus, he was best known for his TV work, including series like The Shield, The Righteous Gemstones. He's also a producer, having worked on Justified, The Hateful Eight, and Predators. It's amazing how many people think that the White Lotus was like, hey, where'd this guy come from? He's an unknown, but he's had a great career, and White Lotus just made it jettison like crazy.
Oh, it did, because I didn't even realize he was in this film until I went back, and then I'm like, oh my gosh, it's the guy from the White Lotus.
And then the last person who plays Ruth, which is Mrs. Claus.
Yeah.
I never knew Mrs. Claus' first name was Ruth. It's Marianne Jean Batiste. She's an English actress. She's also known for her role in Mike Leigh's drama film Secrets and Lies from 1996. She received nominations for the Academy Award, the BAFTA Award, which is the British equivalent to the Oscars, the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress. She's also known for her role as Vivian Johnson on a television series, Without a Trace.
That's how I knew her. I'm like, oh, she's from Without a Trace.
I've never seen that series. Oh, yeah.
It was on the same time as Cold Case, so I confuse them both, but it was good.
She's also a writer and a composer and has recorded an album of blues songs and composed the musical score for Leigh's 1997 film Career Girls. She teamed up again with Mike Leigh, where she played the lead role in a 2024 film called Hard Truth. So, and I would say her name's not familiar, but when you see her, you know you've seen her in other films. Let's talk about this movie. I'm just going to sort of summarize this. It's not a hard, complicated film, but here's the thing. Santa Claus and Ruth Claus, you know, or Chris and Ruth, they're just on hard times. Mm-hmm. The lack of Christmas spirit and belief sort of has them down. But we soon discover, which I never knew this, is that the federal government has been subsidizing Santa. The government sends the Claus family subsidies every year based on how well the shopping was.
Who knew?
Who knew? But with the down year, Santa Claus is having a hard time making ends meet. He's sad. Several suppliers are looking for payment. What are they going to do, foreclose on Santa? But still, Santa's still Santa. He goes to this bar and he orders, I can't remember what the drink was called, but it's a shot of whiskey with an Alka-Seltzer in it. It might have been a Frank Sinatra, I think. You know, you sort of get the sense that he's still the magic of Santa Claus, because the bartender, she's flirting with this guy and he's flirting back, and the bartender leaves and Santa slides over and he goes, you know, you need to go home. Who are you? Why are you talking this way? You need to go home to your wife, Jean, and your three boys. You're not going to be having an affair on Christmas. And the guy's totally spooked. Like, who the hell are you? How do you know this stuff? But then he leaves. So you do get the magic senses of Chris still with his role. There's also a little boy named Billy, sort of like junior high age. He's like the spoiled little shit. In fact, a little shit is what a skinny man calls him on his phone. But he's a spoiled kid. He has a whole staff supporting him. He lives with his grandmother, and he's getting ready to compete in the science project. And as he's going out to compete, his grandma's like, oh, I'm really sorry, Billy. Your dad's not going to be here. He's like, that's unfortunate that I won't get to see John this year. This always refers to his dad. I'm like, wow, this kid's kind of cold. But he has these three previous ribbons. And before he leaves, he writes Santa a note. And he gives it to one of the assistants, says, I need this FedExed overnight tonight. So Santa gets it. And then you have the hitman. They call him the skinny man, Walter Goggins' role. Early in the movie, he's buying all these toys. And the toys have to say, made at Santa's workshop. And he's sort of like a pawnbroker. People are coming in. He says, this bat's worth $3,000. He gives them like $800, right? And he's like, you don't like it, get out of here type of thing. And so those are sort of the backstories of the movie. So we come to find out, Billy does not win his fourth blue ribbon first prize, and he's pissed. Some little girl has won first prize. He's received runner-up. So what does Billy do? He calls Skinny Man and says, I need you to capture her. I need you to kidnap her. And he does. Skinny Man comes in, brings her in. She's tied up on a chair. And Billy comes in with cables hooked up to the battery and says, I'm going to torture you unless you write a note to the committee saying you cheated and that you don't deserve the award. And of course, she's intimidated. And Skinny Man tells her, if you tell anybody, I'm going to kill your parents. I'm going to kill your dog. Going back to Santa. So again, we know he's had a bad year, but the government says, hey, we got a proposal for you. They will guarantee 15 years of subsidy if Santa agrees to switch over his toy-making equipment to build control panels for fighter jets. And Santa's like, nope, I'll never do it. But finally, he says, okay, I'll allow that. And so the elves all get together. Santa has to sort of describe why they're going to be building control panels for fighter jets. They're Santa's elves, so they're all agreeable, but they have to get fingerprinted, get security IDs. They get their bells cut off, their shoes, and so they're getting to make these fighter jet control panels. And the military is very impressed about how efficient they are. They're in the cafeteria having food, And the colonel or major in the army is watching all the elves eat like cake and candy. And he's like, what are you doing? You need carbs. You need vegetables. You can't live this way. And the guy is like, you know, like I'm 110 years old, right? He goes, well, when do you sleep? Said, oh, he goes, we're very efficient. We sleep 20 minutes every 8 hours for full maximum efficiencies. And so the military guy's blown away with like, how could this be happening? So going back to Billy, you never know in the movie, but I think Billy's original note to Santa in the beginning is that Santa would help him get the blue ribbon.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Yeah, because I had to go back. I'm like, they never say so. I think Billy's now mad because Santa didn't deliver. So Billy calls up Skinny Man and says, you know, I really want you to kill Santa. And so for Skinny Man, that's like the ultimate prize, right? Because he doesn't like Santa either. So he agrees to take it on. And also we find out that Billy, to pay for all of this extravagance and for this hitman, has been embezzling money from his grandmother. Nice little kid. But Santa's getting a little reflective. Ruth, I feel uncomfortable calling her Ruth.
Yeah.
Mrs. Claus, she shows a picture of a woman who's a firefighter who's thanking Santa Claus because Santa bought her a fire engine when she was a little kid, a boy who became a chef who got like a cooking toy when he was young. So Santa's starting to feel a little bit better. Skinny Man doesn't know how to find Santa. One of my favorite scenes, he calls information, says, yeah, can I get a listing for a Kris Kringle in the North Pole? They're like, there is no North Pole. I don't know. Find any town that's near it. He devises a way where he's going to trace through the U.S. postal system the letters. So he starts going local and along the way trying to find where Santa gets his mail. Of course, along the way, he kills a bunch of postal people.
Oh, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. And so Skinny Man is keeping in contact with Billy. Another highlight of the movie is when Billy calls Skinny Man for an update, and Skinny Man says, I'm getting closer. And Billy's like, well, I want Santa's head after you kill him. And Skinny Man's like, well, you know, he's very calm. Like, well, you know, like the smell, I got to transport through international lines. Billy goes, what about if you cut his beard off? He's like, I'm not cutting the beard off of a dead man. And so they finally agree that Santa's jacket would be appropriate, but Chris doesn't wear a red jacket. No, he wears like a Carhartt.
Yeah.
So Skinny Man finds Santa's workshop, eventually gets there, right? It's all covered with military. Skinny Man starts shooting up everybody, killing a bunch of the military. I mean, it got pretty violent around this part.
Yeah.
I mean, he was even killing elves.
I know.
But then finally, Santa hears about the attack, comes out of the house with two guns in his hand, and he said, enough. Stop all this. He's like, oh my God, it's Jonathan Miller. He goes, I'm so sorry. You were such a troubled child, Jonathan Miller. The Skinny Man holds up this little police car and says, do you remember this? And Santa says, I do remember this. I'm sorry I couldn't become your parents. And so I think along the lines, we also find out that his parents were dead. He was in foster care, or his stepfather burned his arms with cigarettes. So he was a troubled kid, but there's no emotional breakdown where they hug at all.
No.
So Skinny Man and Fat Man Santa start shooting at each other. They have a hand-to-hand combat. Santa ends up getting shot 2 or 3 times, stabbed 5 or 6 times, actually gets shot point blank in the head, and Santa dies. Well, he doesn't really.
No.
Because what we find out is that Santa apparently can live through anything.
Yes.
Mrs. Ruth sees Skinny Man, shoots at him. Ruth gets shot as well. But in the end, Skinny Man is killed. Santa is mending his way back. And you never really find out why Skinny Man was so angry at Santa, other than he got this police car and maybe he wanted more. But anyway, Ruth kills Skinny Man. Santa's recovering. Billy's grandma finds out someone's been embezzling money and says, I want to find out who that red is. I'll do anything. Billy gets panic and decides to give her milk with some extra fentanyl in it. There's a knock on the front door, and Billy says to his aides and housekeeper, I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to see anybody. And he goes up to his room, but then there's a knock on the door, and in comes Ruth, and in comes Chris.
Yes.
And he's like, you know, I should have done this sooner. No more lumps of coal for people. I'm taking a more proactive approach. People should not be living outside of morals and values. And he tells Billy, is anything ever happens to that little girl, you ever hurt your grandmother or do anything, I'll be back. And he goes, I am Fat Man. And the movie ends with them rebuilding the shops. So that's the movie in a nutshell. So, Bob, do you think it's festive?
I will say I love some of the creative liberties it takes. Yeah. It was a very creative approach. But no, I didn't find it festive at all. And it wasn't just the violence.
Yeah.
Clearly, I think there was a statement that they were trying to make, especially with the involvement of the military. But it didn't register with me at all. It kind of left me kind of flat, to be honest.
Yeah. I was tending a little bit more towards It Was Christmas, but I would say this. The combination of all those reasons you said, plus the quality of the movie, I would say no as well. What was the backstory on Billy and his parents? What was the backstory on Skinny Man that could have made it more interesting?
Yeah, I mean, did you feel like any of the characters had any redemption, really?
None.
No. What I will say is I liked Mel Gibson as Santa. That I did like.
I think I might do a redo of Fat Man.
Yeah.
Because I like the concept of it. Santa's not going to be stepped on and used by all these little kids anymore, right? Yeah. And could Santa make a difference in the world if he did take the baddest of the bad and just like intimidated them?
The fact that he like didn't have the red coat, like you said, and he dressed very normal, that didn't bother me at all. I thought it was kind of a cool take. I like Kurt Russell in the Christmas Chronicles because it's a different look for Santa, more rugged, outdoorsman, Alaska-type look.
Alaska-type. How did you make you feel when you watched it?
I appreciated the production values are great. Yeah. It looks great. I thought Walter Goggins, before I even knew it was him, thought he was most interesting.
I agree.
But it really didn't move me at all. You know, it was a shame. When it first came out, I remember hearing about it. I had a lot of expectations for it. I thought it was going to be good, and I thought it was going to be a really kind of cool alternative take. It left me just empty.
It was easy to watch, but I kept waiting for something to pull it all together. So in the end, it was very blah. Would you watch it again?
You know, I've seen it now a few times because I saw it when it first came out. I don't like the excessive violence. I really don't. And I get it. I think he's purposely making over the top. I thought it was unnecessary.
I think you could have done without it. Yeah. You know, it's funny, I'd say about watching in when we first start talking about reviewing this movie, you asked me, had I ever seen Fat Man? I said, oh, no, I have never seen it. And I start watching, like, I've seen this before. So
just blanked it out.
Would you recommend anybody watch it?
I think if someone wants an interesting take on Santa, like some of the early stuff I kind of liked. And when they tried to show some of the magical elements, I loved all that. Yeah. Maybe the first half hour of the movie. No, I don't think I'd recommend it to someone.
Yeah, I agree. Like that bar scene that I had mentioned before, I thought that was kind of cute.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'd be more interested to say, hey, have you ever seen this movie? And if they have, ask them what they thought of it.
Yeah.
Or if it's somebody who I know likes movies, like, you watch this and tell me what you think about it. Not a, you have to watch this, but I'm curious what you think of it. So
this is what drew us to watch it because it's in Alaska. And I always thought, why did they do that? Maybe to make it more realistic? Place it someplace where there are people.
And remote enough where he could really live the Kris Kringle and Ruth life. I'm not sure. Well, should we talk about how to say Merry Christmas?
Yes, I know. It's called English and you say Merry Christmas.
Or Happy Holidays. Well, in Alaska, I know I worked with a lot of Native Alaskans. I think Bob,
I did too. Yeah.
Love them. Learned a lot. Yeah. There is so many Native languages in Alaska, but we're going to say how to say Merry Christmas and you pick. So to say Merry Christmas, you say Aganika Alusakatrkak. I don't think that's really it, but it's something like Anegnik Alusutaek.
And you got to get that.
Yeah.
Yep.
In Alaska, there's over 20 distinctive indigenous languages. The most common one is Central Yupik, a Native Alaskan language spoken by Yupik people. According to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, there are roughly 25,000 speakers of Yupik. You can also use the more common expression is just one big word that has absolutely no vowels. Agayunapakachikakikach.
Oh, Mark, you do that so well.
Agayunapakachikachik. So that is a way to say, have a very Merry Christmas.
You know, what's interesting is I worked with all women because the guys were out fishing. When you come back to the village to get supplies and they were there and they were Yupik. They spoke Yupik. And these are some of the things I remembered. Like they called us Gusiks. And I think that was from Cossack.
Oh.
So Gusiks. And then they had a nickname for me, which was Aganak. It means girly man. And the reason why they called me that, they said I had curly eyelashes like a girl. So they would call me Aganak.
I am so impressed that you shared that with us. Yeah. That's awesome.
And I used to be able to sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star in Yupik. They taught it to me.
Then why aren't you pronouncing these words?
All I remember is Vraluden was one of the words, but I can't remember. Oh,
that's so funny.
Aganak.
We had several Eskimos in our camp. Never remember them speaking another language. They cook salmon like I've never had before.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. Yeah. But let's talk about some customs in Alaska. After Christmas, discarded Christmas trees are used to create a force in the sea ice off of Nome Shore. Some are even still decorated when they throw these in the water. After the season, on a sub-zero day, the trees are placed in augered holes, which are filled with water, freezing the tree in place. The forest is then populated with wood cutouts of animals. For the next few months, the Nome National Forest delights the residents and visitors. In springtime, the trees are uprooted and used to create fishing spawn habitat in the local rivers, squeezing yet another positive benefit from the discarded trees.
Isn't that great? I love that. You could do that like up in Minnesota and stuff too, you know?
I think it's awesome. Yeah. For some Alaskan family, nothing says Merry Christmas like moose tongue or nose. Moose is often the meat of choice. It's then sliced for sandwiches or used for soup, using all parts of the moose or caribou is important when you're harvesting food from the land. Moose can also be ground into burgers, cut into steaks, and turned into sausages, which I've eaten moose and caribou before.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, caribou's better, much tender. Moose are huge. That's the other thing about going back to Alaska. Like, a couple moose came into our camp. We thought it would be fun to get up close to them. I was more intimidated by the moose than I was the grizzly with her cubs.
You're right. You had no idea how huge they are. God. But what is so funny is they look nice and they're not.
No.
Not at all.
They're not afraid.
No.
Because like when we saw grizzlies got really close, they were about maybe 40 yards from us when we were out in the wilderness. We climbed up the top of our tower and just shot over them and made a bunch of noise and they left. The moose, we actually had a helicopter hovering above them and the moose just kept eating and looking like, I am not moving. The meat can be ground into burgers, steak, sausages. The delicacies are often overcooked parts of the moose. They are considered a special dish saved for Christmas Eve and served with other wild game or a turkey or a ham. Other items of wild game or country food, as it's called, is caribou, seal, muktuk, which is the skin of a whale, and some blubber, is another delicacy of many Inuits. Also, the meat is usually served raw. So, again, going back, like the one thing that they cooked the salmon in was with some seal and whale blubber. They would dry it out. And so when they cooked the salmon, they wrapped it in aluminum foil, threw it in a charcoal pit, but they put whale blubber and seal blubber in and around it. It was unbelievable. Inuit celebrations around the Christmas season often intertwine with another festival called Kosovakwik, which translates to happy day. Kosovakwik celebrates the long winter's end and marks the new sun emerging after the winter solstice and to placate the roaming spirits to bring good luck for the approaching hunting season.
Isn't this amazing how many times we've heard of this exact same type of celebration in many countries around the world?
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Historically, this season is a time to share food stores and exchange handmade gifts. Families would feast on local foods such as seal, whale, caribou, in honor of the spirit of sharing. An explorer in 1864 discovered this event and how the Inuit would have a general meeting in a large snow house. The shaman would pray for prosperity for the coming year. The community would gather, share stories and songs around fires, and to drive away the darkness and cold of the long Arctic nights. Now, Bob, I assumed you were up there when it was daylight all the time, like I was too. Yeah. But I know in the winter, it's just the opposite. It's always dark.
I hated coming out of the bars and it's like fried out at the end of the night.
Yeah, it's just not helping.
Yeah.
Also, they would throw presents from one another with the expectation that each would receive good things from the god Sedna in proportion to how generous they are with each other.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
So they had a gift-giving part of their celebration that had nothing to do with Christmas.
No. I thought it was interesting, too, that the more you give is hopefully the more you receive.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work that way. there are many parallels between Kovasuk and Christmas, with the whole community coming together in one building to pray and to sing, exchange gifts. There was races and games that were held with dog sleds, and Christmas has become more of the celebrated event. The Inuit has retained many of the traditions, but added it to the Christmas holiday instead. Yeah. And then last, this is also interesting, the Alaska National Guard has a tradition of over 60 years serving communities throughout Alaska during the holiday season, delivering Christmas gifts to children in tiny, isolated communities. It's called Op Santa, where Santa and Mrs. Claus, or maybe Chris and Ruth, catch a ride along with 30 elves on a combat king aircraft.
Isn't that crazy? Wow.
The children eagerly anticipate their guests and the event, and usually provide handmade decorations and a display for Santa and Mrs. Claus. Op Santa began in 1956 when the Anchorage community assisted the village of St. Mary's after a natural disaster left them with no money to buy Christmas gifts. The Air National Guard donated goods to the remote village, and since then have been delivering gifts to tens of thousands of children through rural Alaska. Yeah.
This calls for some Christmas music.
Yes, this Christmas music.
What kind of Christmas music is that?
At least you could do is play some Christmas music.
And now back to Christmas music.
Well, it's been fun to talk about Alaska again, a lot of good memories, but we should talk about music from Alaska, or I should say music about Alaska.
From my Alaska home, I'll never roam. It's Christmas every day. The woods are full of Christmas trees and the reindeer pass away. The northern lights are brilliant sights like fireworks on display. I got a bright fireside and a Yukon bride, and it's Christmas every day.
We feel a little bit like we're cheating here because the singer Hank Thompson is not from Alaska. In fact, we don't even know if he was ever in Alaska or if he knows how to spell Alaska. But it was a best song we felt represented Christmas in Alaska. Hank Thompson was one of the most popular Western swing musicians of the 50s and 60s and was born in Texas. Mm. He studied electrical engineering at Princeton, but eventually decided to pursue music as a career.
Does that guy sound like he studied electrical engineering at Princeton?
He returned to Waco and put together his band called the Brazos Valley Boys. He ended up with a number of gold records. He had the very first variety show on television broadcast in color. He was the first country artist to tour with a sound and lighting system.
Because he's an electrical engineer. That's why.
That's right. He was the first to receive a corporate sponsorship and the first to record in stereo.
Isn't that crazy? Wow.
Yeah. He recorded the first live country album ever released. Hank Thompson recorded the song It's Christmas Every Day in Alaska in 1964 for his album called It's Christmas Time. But it is an upbeat holiday tune that describes a faraway Alaskan venture and tells the story of a man who travels north to find his fortune and discovers a gold mine, a wife, and a new life where he feels like it's Christmas all year long. The song highlights the beauty of Alaska, including the northern lights and the abundance of wildlife as year-round Christmas gifts.
And that's really why we picked it. No, we kind of like the ones that we can move and shake.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would also say it's a very over-dramatization of how nice it is in Alaska.
Yes. Yes.
It is beautiful there.
It is.
But as Bob ever mentioned too, like people work hard.
Yeah.
And they're in the work seasons is short. Anyway.
It's Christmas dinner.
Eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
Food they put out for Christmas Eve.
Eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
Most of your major food preparation holidays, Christmas.
Eat it.
What's up, food for Santa?
Eat it.
There's no chili. No, chili's not a festive food.
Can we go back and talk more about pierogies?
Oh, I'd love to.
All right. So
when do we get to eat the pierogi, Mark?
We're getting there. We are getting there, right? We got to perfect this, right? So a few episodes I shared with you that I had ventured into the Latvian food Facebook group, right?
Yes, 28,000 friends or whatever.
Yeah, 27, 28, I don't know. You know, 210, 110, whatever it takes. I've been fascinated by what I've discovered about their food and culture. I've put on 10 pounds just reading about them. During my exploring, I stumbled on Gary Dickerson. He has a YouTube channel called The Baltic Homesteaders.
Wow.
And on this channel, Gary, who's actually from the UK, talks about moving with his Latvian wife, Gina, to her home country with their daughter. Even more interesting, Bob, is that Gary makes the claim that he has perfected the pierogi recipe, and he's developed a master class to prove his point. And so I tracked him down, messaged him. He had to believe I was crazy.
Wait. Can I reverse something for a minute?
Yeah.
He's from the UK.
Yes.
His wife's from Latvia.
Yes. Yes. Very interesting guy. Like I said, they live on a farm now. I have listened to his Baltic Homesteaders YouTube channel for a couple of things. One was, I thought was interesting, is I like to grow a garden every year. Soon I've been talking about the soil the last couple of years is, I don't think, producing as much. And so we've kind of made a commitment to compost, especially eggs because of the protein in it. And I was sort of reading how to do that. And guess whose YouTube channel pops up? Gary's. And he talks about how baking the eggs and crunching them in small pieces can get the protein out faster, soaking them in water after you bake them. So this guy is fascinating. We are going to share with you our conversation with Gary, the man from UK who lives in Latvia, who claims to have perfected the recipe.
We've been on this quest to find more about Latvia and more about pierogi. And
the way we got onto pierogi was we go through and we do a show and we usually talk about Christmas tradition and generally the food because we all love the food. Mark and I at the end of the year will vote on what our favorite thing was. And just ironically, we both heard about the pierogi, bacon rolls.
Bacon buns, yeah.
We were so excited about them that we both picked them as our favorites.
Bob and I have been talking with different people. We spoke to someone from the Latvia Embassy in Washington, D.C. We spoke to a professor.
And the professor that we spoke to, she moved her family to Latvia for a year. She taught English there for a year. Okay. It's kind of fun to talk to someone from the U.S. who went and lived there and could describe like the Latvian people and living in Latvia.
I joined the Latvian food Facebook page. That's how I found you. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Are you Latvian?
No, I'm married to a Latvian, Gita. We've been married for 20 years. This is not our first time living in Latvia. This is our second time, actually. So 20 years ago, we lived in Riga for 3 years and then went back to the UK and lived back in the UK for about 10 years. Gita's parents have always lived here in the countryside. Her father fell ill, so Gita happened to be out here anyway on holiday and had to look after him. And we thought the end would be coming soon. And so I stayed in the UK and the end didn't come after 8 months. He was still alive, so we decided that we would just move out here, really, because we had to be together, and we'd been apart for 8 months. So we moved back to Latvia, but completely different setup with being in the countryside rather than in the capital city.
Were you born and raised in the UK?
Yeah.
Oh, so you have a different perspective. What do you like about living in Latvia?
I don't think it's just Latvia. It's like being in the countryside. And when we say in the countryside, we are in the middle of nowhere and a bit further. We're in the middle of a forest on a beaten track. Our nearest village is about 5 miles away. It's just so peaceful and you can, to a degree, do what you like. There are pros and cons to that. I was quite cut off as well in winter and remote and you can get stuck and that kind of stuff. But you can prepare for that. So I kind of like the more relaxed pace of life. It took some getting used to. Now I'm sort of there and everything's a bit haphazard sometimes. That's kind of how life works.
Did you live in the country in England?
We didn't live in a city, but we lived in a town with about 8,000 people. It was a seaside town, tourist sort of town, so very busy in the summer, not so much in the winter. Everything was sort of within walking distance.
So this is a big change.
This is a big change.
Why did you decide to become the master chef of pierogi?
The masterclass of pierogi was a little tongue-in-cheek. Nobody loves more than an Englishman telling other people how to cook their national dish. So you have to do stuff these days to grab people's attention. And
that's why you're our national hero, too.
That's right. That was kind of brash when I'm like, he does not sound like he's from Latvia. I could be wrong, but I'm sensing he's not. So when's the first time you had a pierogi?
Well, it would have been the first time we came here, really. I do remember we lived in an apartment in Riga, not too far from the centre, and there was a bakery about a block down the street, and we could pop over, and it was my go-to snack when Gita was away or something and I was at home and I wanted something quick. There were no sausage rolls, no pork pies, nothing like that here. They were sort of the grab-and-go snack, little buns in a bag. I was onto them almost immediately. My nose led me to them as soon as I arrived in the country.
When we first saw them, and this might be part of the problem with translation, they were calling them bacon pies. But then since then, when we've done more investigation, they're really now called rolls or hand rolls or things like that. So they're really more like rolls. They're not like a pie, right?
English is a much richer language than Latvian. You know, there are hundreds of thousands more words in English than there are in Latvian. So a lot of things are clumped together. Pirogs or pirogi, I would be the plural. Pirogs is pie. Pirogi would be pies. Whereas we have things like roll, bun. So they're all clumped together. The pastry is a yeast-based pastry. So, you know, really they should be called something like a roll or bun. The proper name actually for them is pirodzini, is the full name. Pirodzini. When they're baked around Christmas, everyone tends to move to the word pirogi for some reason. And then for the other part of the year, they call them pirodzini.
That's helpful because we were thinking they were more like pies, but I think you're right. They're more like rolls.
Yeah. And they don't really have pies here. You know, think something like a pumpkin pie, deep pie, you wouldn't necessarily see here. They do more kind of like, they do like a pie base and then put layers on, and they'll call it platzmeiser, which translates as flatbread. We think of flatbread as something else. On the top, they would put either some like crumble mixture or sour cream and then shove it in the oven and bake it. I've done a couple of those kind of things on videos, but yeah, you don't very often see here like a round pie or hot pies like steak and onion pie or something like that. You wouldn't see that here.
Tell us how you came up with your approach to making it.
I wanted to be that bridge to bring really great Latvian food to an international audience and bake it here in our kitchen and speak in English so that most of the world can understand it and most of the Latvians can argue about it, how wrong it is or something. But and specifically with the pierogi, what I was seeing in that group that you went in the Facebook group, Latvian food lovers, this cycle of every year, the build-up to, because many people will start now and then freeze them, the build-up to Christmas with the baking of the pierogi, everyone's gotten a recipe and everyone was saying, can you give me your recipe? And if I could do one easy recipe, and I have to do a little bit of science, that's just me, and, you know, make it foolproof and demonstrate that I've done it, and it's like repeatable as well. In scientific terms, we call it empirical. And, you know, it's repeatable and it's fairly easy and people can just copy that. And when someone asks for it, I can just give them a link to a video. You know, what could be easier?
Are you a cook? Is this what you do? Because you sound so knowledgeable and very scientific as well.
I sort of fell into food a bit. We were in Norfolk, which is on the east side of the UK, and there is a huge amount of artisan producers there making some fantastic food. And I sort of fell into that world, made friends in that world, and then got work out of that world or within that world. And then even started a small charcuterie business with two other people in that world as well. So I was part of it, but I was also doing food marketing. My clients were food orientated. I did a lot of work for Big Green Egg, which I know is a famous brand in America.
Yes, yes.
So I worked with their British licensee, trying to help them get their heads around British barbecue and culture, which is very different to perhaps in the States. When we left, we kind of left almost everything. It was difficult to bring that over here with me, but the passion in the heart was still there, you know, the food. When I started the YouTube channel, there's not a lot of gardening to do in winter, so I focus on food, and that's when most of the recipes videos tend to come out, is in the wintertime.
One of our shows, we may actually be following your masterclass while we try to bake them, so if you don't mind. Of the things you've highlighted, two things stood out to me. One is, I guess we found the right item that's reflective of Christmas in Latvia, being the pierogi, and then also that you also think it's something to be shared with the world.
It's got bacon in it. I mean, what more could be?
That's what we think.
I'm sure you thought the same thing as me. Why am I only discovering these in Latvia? It's like Latvia's best kept secrets. It would definitely work in the States, and it would definitely work in the UK. There's two really important things for Christmas. Is pierogi is the savoury item, and pepper cookies, sometimes translated as gingerbread, but it's not really the same thing. But these thin cookies, which are, have got various sweet spices in them and some black pepper, and then you decorate them with icing. And both those things can be really family orientated as well. They require batch making, and people can get around a table, and not in the masterclass one, but in another pierogi video that I've done, and I've done Christmas traditions as well. It's us getting around a table with the cookies. Someone's cutting them, someone's icing them, someone's baking them, and someone's eating them. And with the pierogi as well, someone will be rolling it, someone will be filling it, someone might be frying more bacon, and it's actually bacon and onion inside it, not just bacon. But there's no screens involved, no phones, you know what I mean, and no TV, and just the radio in the background, and you're around a table and maybe a candle in the background. It's all quite scenic, and you're making this lovely food, which you're then going to share and eat.
What Gary just described, the ambiance of making them.
That's why we need that beautiful Latvian countryside to be surrounding us.
Log fire, you know.
Gary, those cookies sound awesome too.
If you go to someone's house, there's always a bowl of pepper cookies lying about to share.
So how about some tips in terms of making pierogies? What things should we know about or be aware of before we start this venture?
So, I mean, you've got three components. You've got the dough, and then you've got the onions and the bacon. In some respects, two components, because the onions and bacon are fried together. So you want a nice stretchy dough, forgiving dough. You saw and you mentioned this scalded flour that I used. If you bake them well enough, they don't last long because they're all eaten. But let's just say, theoretically, they were to last more than a day. You still want them quite fresh the next day, really, not stale. And when I was reading people's problems in the recipe request columns and threads, people share their problems as well. One of the problems was they were getting fed up with the pastry going stale very quickly. One answer to that is, well, you're not eating them quick enough, obviously. But
they don't have us around.
Yeah, quite. So I did some research, and I found this method. Tangzong it is in Chinese. And I researched it, and it's really popular and big in China and Japan at the moment, for softening bread and having a slightly longer shelf life. And when I researched it more, actually, I found out that actually it is a tradition from Europe of way gone many, many hundreds of years ago, which got left by the lay-by and then was picked up by someone in China some centuries later, and then it became sort of their thing. But actually, it did originate in Europe. What it does is, by scalding the flour, you open the crystals of gluten and you allow them to soak in more moisture. So when you then put that into the dough, it allows the dough to retain more moisture, thus allowing it to be, after a day, the pastry will be still moist rather than going dry if they're left out on a countertop or something, you know. So I know that adds a layer of complexity to it, but I thought, well, I'll give that a go and see if it makes a difference. And I really found that the dough was so much softer and more pliable. And I can't testify about how long it lasts because they're just gone. You know, they never last more than a day. Other people have testified that it did make a difference. And then, of course, it's all about the generosity of your filling. Once you've got your pastry made, and how generous do you make your filling with, how much bacon and onions do you put inside? And that was a little controversial as well. People said I was a bit stingy in the video. I don't know if you've seen it. I then did a follow-up. I listened to their criticisms, and I did, how much filling can I get in a pierogi? So I made the same mixture, and then each filling I put in 5 grams more in each pierogi until it split, and it didn't work. Just to see how much you can get in, sort of thing, and show to people. I line them all up. I split them all in half and line them all up. I said, here you go. Like a lot of things, it's very personal. Some people like quite bready. Some people like it full of meat and the bread like thin like a pancake, where there's no room for it to expand. And I said, take your pick. Here you go. Make it personal to you.
I was wondering, which did you prefer? The one that you were considered stingy, or when you later stuffed it more?
I think more towards the lower side. I accepted that perhaps I could put more in, and I think, but I do put more filling in now than I used to, but not that much more, maybe an extra teaspoon or something like that, you know, double up. I think most people do like that slightly airy, soft bread bun, you know, around the filling, combination of both together.
I'm starving now. I want to try one. Is it hard to work with the yeast?
No, I don't think so. What I do is I make sure that the yeast is working, so I always do the yeast in a separate, I I think I did it in the video. I put it into a separate glass bowl with some warm milk, put the yeast in and make sure it's frothing up before I put it in the mix, just to make sure it is alive. I think if you want to use natural yeast, you just double the weight of the yeast.
It sounds like you smoke your own bacon. Take us through that process. I mean, do you buy that bacon then smoke it, or do you have animals on your farm?
Yeah, so it's interesting. When pierogi season cracks off here, the shops go mad. You can buy ready-to-go chopped bacon. It looks like ground pork, but it's cured bacon. You can buy that off the shelf, or you can buy the lumps of meat, which are cured bacon. The meat that's used does tend to be more on the fatty side, so it is the kind of the belly pork bacon. And in fact, some people just use chops of things of fat and make it much more fatty sort of thing. Yeah, health goes out the window here. It's all about taste. I wouldn't feel obliged that you have to use smoked bacon. You know, regular bacon would work just as well. I think the smoking obviously adds an extra element to it.
If we really wanted to do traditional pierogi, would it be use the smoked bacon then?
It's a good question. And the honest answer is I don't know. But what I can tell you is that smoked meat is really huge here. That was another kind of eye-opener when I got here. In the UK, smoked meat tends to be a premium product. You'll pay way over the odds for smoked meat. It's a luxury product. Whereas here, it's just like ready. It's the norm. We still have a market in our nearest city. And there are small producers there. And the glass cabinets are full of that black, brown smoked meat. And there are what they call home smoked, which is really dark black. And then there's commercial smoked, which is more that browny, reddy colour that you're probably more used to. So you get two different types of smoking as well here.
Mark, when you say here it's luxury as well, it's an upgrade.
I would agree.
We have really fallen in love with these Baltic states. We were very unfamiliar with them. The movies have been so entertaining. The countries have been beautiful, and it seems like the people embrace the outdoors quite a bit. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, there's a really deep connection with nature here. Latvia is 52% forested, and wood is the biggest export here, and all the forests are managed. But yeah, very deep connection with nature. People understand. They love to go foraging for chanterelles, other mushrooms as well. You'll get real blueberries, not blueberries that make your mouth blue, not the ones that you get in the fields. Lingonberries, cranberries at the moment. We just come back with a big bucket of cranberries from the nearest swamp, and wild raspberries, wild strawberries, all sorts, you know. So and people obviously keep their favorite places secret and stuff like that, but you'll see people with buckets around, and you think, oh, when do they do it? You know that they're mushroom picking or whatever, foraging.
You're making us hungry again. Obviously, people can tell by your accent that you're not Latvian. Are they friendly to you, or do you find them to be open?
It's always an immediate suspicion, I think, particularly as I'm in the countryside, not in the capital. You kind of expect the cosmopolitan aspect of it, international cosmopolitan aspect in the capital. But why is this English guy in this little village with 1,000 people in this parish? You know, I'm the only English guy in the village. So there's always a what do you do sort of questions and why are you here and all that sort of stuff. We're now 7 years in, so everyone knows who I am.
Everybody. They're like, that's the English guy.
Yeah. Once you move beyond that, for initial suspicion, people are really heartwarming and hospitable and offer great hospitality. And they'll give you the time of day when you pass. I'm by no means fluent. It is one of the more difficult languages to learn, but I can get by and I can have converse with people on a sort of daily basis sort of thing. So I can chat to people, and that's really nice, you know.
Have you taken lessons, or did you just pick it up from living there?
It's very much submersive just being here. When we were in the capital in Riga, I did hire a primary school teacher to come and teach me privately, and she taught me like a school child. It was quite good. It's what I needed then. But here with, you know, Gita's mum doesn't speak English, and most people in the village, apart from the young ones, don't speak English. So it's kind of do or die to a degree. And our daughter is bilingual. Mostly my wife will speak in Latvian to her, and I will mostly speak in English to her. She's had a year of Russian. She's now moved to German. She speaks obviously in English and Latvian.
What are some lasting impressions you'll leave with us about Latvia, about your experience in Latvia or pierogi as well?
Do you have to taste them to have that lasting impression, I suppose? What can I say to someone who's not tasted them? I mean, you know yourself that you have to taste them. You need that saltiness. It's that saltiness, I think, and the onion that works so well. And of course, you're drawn in with the baking. If you imagine it, when you're making it, you've got the yeasty bread, which is releasing those kind of bready vapors into the air. You've got someone frying onion and bacon. And then you've got them combined and the whole lot going in the oven and being cooked again. You've got this whole different levels of things going on in the house. You know that they talk about when they sell a house that you should have the smell of baked bread or fresh coffee.
Yes,
if you were to do pierogi, the first person through the door would buy the house.
Oh, I have to remember that.
That's a great thing to leave us with. I love that. Yes.
I have the romantic sort of feel like living out in the woods, living on your own.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I just like there's some just something so engaging, endearing about it, but I feel like I would probably die within a year.
I can speak about my experiences in Latvia to Latvians, and I've actually caused many of them to cry, and I've caused many of them to be very homesick, those that have kind of emigrated away. And I've even had people who've contacted me saying, I'm actually decided to move back because of your videos.
I think this is the most that we've advanced, Bob, on the topic of pierogies.
Gary, once we take your class and we pass the master class, you can make up some kind of a diploma to give us.
So we'll have to do that, definitely.
Trivia time.
It's trivia.
So when it comes to giving away our stickers, it's not just about sharing a piece of paper. There's power in it because these carry the essence of Alaska in them just like we do. The Festive fans once had a dream to explore and to find the wild corners of the world waiting to be discovered and to make money. Each one of these stickers shared our wild heartbeat that is yet to be untamed. And Bob, did you ever reflect this was one more thing that brought us together, right? We knew each other. Then we found out we both like Christmas. Yeah. We both like movies. We both married beautiful, intelligent women. Like, I always slipped that in.
More beautiful and more intelligent than us.
Well, that's a low bar. Like when, somehow I don't even know when we first discovered that we worked in Alaska.
It was much later.
It was crazy. Yeah. So we were meant to be together. But it's not just any sticker in the way that Alaska is just any place. They are both vast, cold, and breathtaking, lit up like the northern sky, dancing with color. So if you want to display your own bit of 4F sticker on your laptop or folder, there's one last towering peak to the summit. One last icy glacier to crest, one last frozen trail to mush. You need to answer our festive fun fact trivia.
Ooh, I'm going to see. Okay.
Right. We wanted our trivia to be as big and awe-inspiring as the state itself. We considered asking you about how Alaska has over 3 million natural lakes.
Or
even more coastline than the rest of the United States combined. Or even how it's bigger than California, Texas, and Montana combined. We thought about quizzing you on how just the city of Anchorage is the size of the state of Delaware.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, having lived in Delaware, not really. Oh. We could test you on the fact that during World War II, the Japanese invaded the Aleutian Islands, making that the only fighting in North America, and how more Americans were killed or wounded there than in Pearl Harbor.
I never knew that.
Yeah. You know what? I didn't either. When I went out there, though, I remember I learned more there from the natives I worked with than I had ever in history class. Yeah. We even considered some fun factoids, like how it's illegal to be knowingly drunk in a bar in Alaska.
Knowingly.
How it is the state where most people walk to work.
Wow.
So more people walk to work than any other state. That's crazy. How Alaska averages 100 earthquakes a day, or even how a plumber there invented ranch dressing.
Wow.
People are Googling this right now. Finally, we wondered if you knew how having 20 hours of sunshine in Alaska causes the produce to grow freakishly large, like a 138-pound cabbage, a 65-pound cantaloupe, or a 35-pound broccoli.
To use with that plumber-invented ranch dressing.
That's right. No, instead, in the spirit of holiday celebrating, we want to know what is the unique way the residents of Glacier View, Alaska, celebrate the 4th of July. What do they do? If you know, there is a mini adventure waiting to happen in your hand. We'll send you a sticker that will make your spirit glow like frozen fire, soar like a bald eagle, or tug like a salmon on your line. I've heard it told that if you hold it to your ear, you can hear the crackle of the ice and the wind blowing on the North Slope. You can claim your adhesive journey now. Send your answer to festivefans@gmail.com. Got a little dramatic this yes, week, thing. Exactly. All right, my quote from my all-time favorite philosophers. Do you have like a list of top 10 philosophers?
Yeah, no.
I don't either. But this one, he is my favorite.
If you had a favorite.
No, I do. Okay. It's him. Christmas is a together sort of holiday.
George Carlin?
Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I like Winnie the Pooh.
I love Winnie the Pooh. Our next episode, we will be reviewing the very topical Life and Death of a Christmas Tree from 2023. We will be exploring the country of Georgia for the first of our two December episodes during the most wonderful time of the year as we count down to our live show. What better way to build the anticipation than to watch a documentary on how an industry has been developed around Georgian firs, which are deemed to be the best Christmas trees. The European Christmas tree industry is worth almost 3 billion euros a year.
That's crazy.
The film features mountains and woodcutters and Christmas tree farmers. You can find The Life and Death of a Christmas Tree on Netflix. You can also rent it on the iTunes platform.
Ooh.
All right, Bob, it's been fun to revisit Alaska with you.
It has. And I was thinking, as I was going to say before, was that I can tell how much money your company made that they could fly you on helicopters every day.
Well, I mean, literally, we would fly to the sides of mountains. I mean, we would, because they would bid on large parcels of land. But yeah, it was a fun experience. I still find it one of the most unique things I've ever heard somebody do. It was like working up in Alaska, you on a ship, me in the on a drill rig. So,
you know, if this were a movie, you know what would happen right now? We'd leave and get in helicopters and fly away.
All right, Bob. Good night.
Good night, Mark. Or as the Yupik say, I don't know. That one they didn't teach me. Not goodbye.
All right.
Actually, we're done.
Done, done.
It's over. Over, over. It's over.
It's over. Kaput. Finito.
It's over. It's over. It's over.
This has been a Waysound Studio production.
And sound engineering on our show is by Jake Fontana.